Let's start this back up. So I don't have any pictures for Paradise Lost and no music. Although there are a number of references to music in Paradise Lost, but carrying forward with the themes that we've been talking about, there are a couple of ways that I think Paradise Lost gives us the quintessential Milton, not simply in the sense that it's one of the great poems in the English language and it's Milton's greatest work, and it's the only epic poem, it's the outstanding epic poem in English and so on and so forth. But as a matter of fact, originally, Milton was planning on a tragedy on the fall of Adam and Eve. It was going to be a drama. He was going to write an epic poem, all right, an English epic, but it was going to be on the subject of King Arthur. So it's interesting that after the fall of the Commonwealth and the Restoration, that he would shift from a national epic to the epic of mankind. And in so doing, what he did was, in some respects, pick up that central theme from Comus and give it a much wider scope. By then he was blind, of course, and it's sometimes been said that his blindness resulted in a peculiar sound to his verses. But I think the peculiar sound to his verses comes from his desire to create a Virgilian form of English. Now, what's peculiar about Paradise Lost is that it creates a new form of poetic diction in English. Before Milton, I suppose the poet who was most responsible for creating a special poetic language was Edmund Spenser. Not only in The Faery Queen, but in almost everything he wrote, all the way back to The Shepherd's Calendar. And of course, Spenser was also a Cambridge graduate, so Milton was aware of him in many different ways. But Spenser's device in The Faery Queen was to sound epic by sounding removed from the ordinary world, and his tool for doing that was to sound Chaucerian, or at least archaic, sometimes simulated archaism rather than real archaism, although a great deal of what is in Spenser really is based on earlier vocabulary and English expressions and grammatical forms. Milton, on the contrary, now sees a chance to resolve the ancient quarrel that set Jerusalem against Athens, or the pagan world on the one hand and the Judeo-Christian world on the other. And he brought these together especially in a Greek tragedy in form with an Old Testament subject, Samson Agonistes. But we're going to talk about Paradise Lost. And in Paradise Lost, Milton expands the Comus character into Satan. And he expands the lady, the young lady, and her two brothers into Adam and Eve, but with a difference, because Eve doesn't resist temptation. Now, what I want to do is just go through a few key speeches and give you my, well, let's face it, my lifelong experience with other human beings, because I find that Milton illuminates everything from committee meetings to marital discussions, to say nothing of just plain old arguments. Let's look first at our initial glimpse at Satan. Now, somewhere, luckily, you always get book and line number in Paradise Lost, and so it's not too hard to find things. At the beginning, we get the fall of the rebel angels from Paradise. And you notice that there are a number of very interesting things going on. So first of all, Milton elevates his subject, but he chooses to allude to classical Latin. That is, to Latin as it was written before Christian times, and therefore we can call it a pagan idiom. And in so doing, he wrenches English out of its natural word order very often. In other words, he treats English sometimes as though it were a declined language. He does this for two reasons. One is that the very language of the poem alludes to the Aeneid throughout. By the way, the first edition of Paradise Lost was in 10 books. Later, he changed it to 12 books. Why 10? There's been a lot of speculation. There's only one well-known epic that's in 10 books. It's the Portuguese national epic, Os Lusíadas by Camões. I don't think Milton had Camões's great poem in mind. I think the number 10 is a Dantesque number originally. But later he reshuffled the poem into 12 books, and that reshuffling, which didn't eliminate or add any lines, was simply intended to reflect the Virgilian origins, or the Virgilian allusion, better put, that's constant throughout the poem. All right, so Aeneas and the Trojans then are exiled from Troy, and they found a new city, Rome, after a few false starts. That's basically the plot of the Aeneid. Aeneas, the hero of the poem, is a great warrior and a great man, but personally not terribly interesting. Dido is a lot more interesting than Aeneas. Turnus is a lot more interesting than Aeneas. The villains are a lot more interesting than Aeneas. And one might say that in Paradise Lost, just as Aeneas is a kind of bland personality, so Adam is a kind of bland personality. And Eve and Satan are far more interesting characters. And as a result, we tend to look at them, and they take on the guise of, I think, ultimately, the real protagonist and antagonist in the poem, exactly like Comus and the lady. But it's not simply that Milton adopts a style of English that constantly reminds us of Virgil and of Latin, but he also uses syntax and word order in very interesting ways. And I would call this a component of what we think of now as Baroque prose style in verse. Now, if you look at Baroque prose, say Sir Thomas Browne or Milton's own prose, Areopagitica, for instance, you'll discover that the typical device in many of these writers is that of the period. Now, a period is a phrase which places the most important information at the end. All right, so in Latin, for example, where the verb very often comes at the end, so the word that gives life to all the other words in the sentence, then is in the final position. And that means, of course, that it gets the greatest emphasis. Second after the last word is, of course, the first word. And then the middle gets the least emphasis. Now, if you notice that this is a syntactical aspect of Latin, that Latin has a very free word order. So Milton loosens up word order so that he can use words for emphasis in different ways. And sometimes he uses them in pictorial fashion. This is something that was pointed out many, many years ago in a book by Donald Davies called Articulate Syntax. And Here it is in book one at line, where is it? I've lost it. It's a long period. Let's see. Look at line 40. We'll begin a little bit earlier. He trusted to have equaled the Most High if he opposed. Oh, by the way, notice that Milton adopts blank verse. Blank verse was not used for poetry of this sort generally. Blank verse was a dramatic verse. It was used in drama, not in long poems. Although, guess who invented blank verse in English? The Earl of Surrey in the 1530s. And he used blank verse to translate the Aeneid into English. He translated books 2 and 4 of the Aeneid into English, and he created the first blank verse. He stole that idea from the Italians, who were the real inventors of blank verse, by the way. But you see, there is a heritage here. On the one hand, there is a dramatic allusion to Shakespeare. On the other, there is a "I can outdo Spencer" sort of ploy going on, and there is a Virgilian, Shakespearean, Dantesque layer all wrapped into this one poem. Now, look what he does with the syntax here, though. So at line 40, he trusted to have equaled the Most High if he opposed. Who's he? He is still Satan. He could equal the Most High if he opposes him. And with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt. Look what he does there. Look at the position of that phrase, with vain attempt. It comes at the beginning of a line, and so it stands prominently, but it comes last in the line, in the sentence. And up until that point, we get Satan's point of view, and those three words are the editorial point of view, the poet's comment, with vain attempt, because clearly Satan doesn't consider his attempt vain. By the way, you recall that Milton was the Latin secretary, today we would call him the Secretary of State, in Cromwell's government. And Cromwell had, of course, rebelled against the king and monarch. And so Milton was familiar with what it meant to revolt against the Most High. But he's talking about God, not a mere man. Now, this extraordinary half line that follows. And notice, we're in the middle of the line. Him, the almighty power, hurled. This is object, subject, verb. Not an English construction at all. It's possible in English because we distinguish between he, subject, and him, object. Right? But this is a Latinate construction, and it's done for a very interesting reason. But let's read through the whole sentence first. Him, the almighty power, hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky with hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. Look how far removed that apposition is in the last part of the sentence. who, so let's straighten this sentence out. I used to have a lot of fun asking students to diagram this sentence. The almighty power hurled him who durst defy the omnipotent to arms, with hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire. Okay. Well, all right, you can say, this is Milton playing Latin. Oh no, think about it for a minute. This sentence is upside down. And how does Satan look falling from the heavens? He's upside down. This is what Davies calls articulate syntax. In other words, the very form of the sentence depicts the fall of Satan. The sentence is upside down, and so is Satan, and Satan's thinking is upside down. He thinks he can equal the Most High when all he can do is fall. And notice that Satan's language, when we first hear him speak, is also marked by a very strange kind of syntactical arrangement. Look at line 84. So Satan has fallen. They've fallen as far as they're going to go. And he turns to Beelzebub and breaks the horrid silence. If thou beest he, but oh, how fallen, how changed from him, who in the happy realms of light, clothed with transcendent brightness, did outshine myriads, though bright, if he, whom mutual league, united thoughts and counsels, equal hope and hazard in the glorious enterprise, joined with me once, now misery hath joined in equal ruin. Into what pit thou seest, from what height fallen, so much the stronger proved he with his thunder. Until then, who knew the force of those dire arms? Yet not for those, nor what the potent victor in his rage can else inflict, do I repent or change, though changed in outward luster. That fixed mind and high disdain from sense of injured merit, that with the mightiest raised me to contend, and to the fierce contention brought along innumerable forces spirits armed, that durst dislike his reign, and me preferring his utmost power with adverse power opposed, in dubious battle on the plains of heaven, and shook his throne. Now notice the trick here. Satan has placed what last? And shook his throne. Did Satan shake God's throne? No. So Satan is playing the same rhetorical tricks here that his fall described. The poet, you see, can say in vain at the end. And Satan does exactly the same thing, but he does it in self-justification. Or rather, look back at that sentence again, and you'll notice that this is an incredibly incoherent sentence. If thou beest he, now what should be the next phrase? He's looking at Beelzebub and says, God, you look, well, demigod, you look awful. Are you really Beelzebub? So what should the next phrase be? What would you think? Make up something. You've fallen down, you know, who knows how many trillion, quadrillion miles, light years, whatever it took, and they land and he looks over and says, yeah, I thought, I remember I hadn't seen a student since 1969, and I didn't recognize him, of course. And he said, gosh, you're so much older. Yeah. I didn't want to say to him, if thou beest he. But I was tempted, because he was a freshman in my Milton class. Yes, indeed. All right, look what happens. If thou beest he, but he can't bring himself to say, if thou beest he, then what must I look like? You see? What must I look like? We don't have mirrors down here in hell, but I have to worry that I look as bad as you do, Beelzebub. But oh, how fallen, how changed from him. Notice here he's saying, you look really different. If he, now, so first of all, your appearance is different. If he, who mutual league, united thoughts and counsels, equal hope and hazard in the glorious enterprise, joined with me once, we're all full of hope for our cause. And now, we're both together in this misery, in equal ruin. If he, we didn't know about the thunder. See, he had a superior force of arms. He's Jove. It's not God the Father. This is Jupiter. This is a pagan god. Well, who would have known? Who could have known? No, the force of those dire arms. We couldn't have guessed. Well, all right. He says, I don't know. And he says, I don't know what else is going to happen. But notice here that this is a series of, I would say, almost stream of consciousness phrases. Satan is just saying his mind, but it's not syntactically connected. It's all disconnected. And it's disconnected in a different way from the description of Satan falling. But it does exactly the same thing. It gives us satanic psychology here, because he is proud and he will not admit that he is defeated, not even to himself, much less to Beelzebub. Well, let us turn to book two. This is going to be the express version of Paradise Lost, but you've all read it anyway. So I have to give you something that I hope you haven't heard before. All right, so book two. Book two is one of my favorites. Every time I go to a committee meeting, I think, oh boy, reread book two. So Satan addresses the assembled fallen angels. He's got them all together here now. What will he say? Powers and dominions. Remember, they're still angels. So they still have these titles. They're empty titles, but they're titles. Sort of like full professor. Doesn't seem to mean much. Well, not to me, anyway. Powers and dominions, deities of heaven. Yes, in the pagan world, they would be deities. In the Christian world, they're not. For since no deep within her gulf can hold immortal vigor, though oppressed and fallen, I give not heaven for lost. From this descent, celestial virtues rising will appear more glorious and more dread than from no fall. Now that's a very important statement. Do you realize why? What's he saying? In effect. And just paraphrase it. Yeah. Which means what? There's a poem by George Herbert, an older contemporary of Milton's, a poem called Easter Wings. You know that poem? And the last line is, then shall the fall further the flight in me. It's the theme of the whole poem. Here, perversely claimed by Satan. My fall will make me even stronger. I will be greater because of my fall. They'll be more afraid of me. So in the case of Adam and Eve, if they can't rise to their former powers, unfallen, heaven itself will stoop to them to match their virtue. So this is the whole concept of redemption, then, that is central to the poem. The idea is that man, and this is very much a Puritan theme, but it's not just Puritan, of course, it's Augustinian, it's a Christian theme par excellence. Man, weakened by the fall, then needs heaven's help in order to rise, not only back to where he was, but he will go beyond his original natural state. All right, so this is what Satan is claiming. He claims that he is going to do this without a redeemer. That's the whole point. All right, so he says, the debate is open. Don't you love it in committees when somebody says, all right, we're open for suggestions and debate. What do you think about this? And Satan says, what you think is the best way for us to proceed? By open war or covert guile? The floor is open. And Moloch steps up. The fiercest spirit to have fought in heaven. And you know this guy. You get these guys. Let's make war. My sentence is for open war. Of wiles more unexpert I boast not. Them let those contrive who need. Notice the placement of them. Again, a point of emphasis. Are when they need, not now. For while they sit contriving, shall the rest, millions that stand in arms and longing wait the signal to ascend, sit lingering here, heaven's fugitives, and for their dwelling place accept this dark, opprobrious den of shame, the prison of his tyranny, who reigns by our delay. Are we going to sit here and take this? No, come on, get up there, fight. Let's not shilly-shally around. No more discussion. We're wasting our time. Get out there and do it. Well, how is that received? He ended frowning at line 106, and his look denounced desperate revenge and battle dangerous to less than gods. Now, he ends, of course, by saying, if we can't get victory, we can get revenge. By God. On the other side, up rose Belial, an act more graceful and humane, a fairer person lost not heaven. He seemed for dignity composed and high exploit, but all was false and hollow. You know these guys. Cowards. But they say, oh, but you know, that's so irrational. Let's be, you know, thinking beings. Let's think this through a little bit. And he starts out, and by the way, here's a good clue next time you get in one of these situations. I couldn't agree more with my precursor, but... notice what Belial does here. I should be much for open war, O peers, as not behind in hate. If what was urged main reason to persuade immediate war did not dissuade me most and seemed to cast ominous conjecture on the whole success. And I can imagine everybody saying, huh? What did he just say? I don't get it. What do you mean? Wait, what he said dissuaded me from what he said? I don't get it. Explain yourself. Well, he says, what revenge? How are we going to take revenge? That place is armed all around. The towers of heaven are filled. And he says, all right, they scorn surprise. What, a sneak attack? I don't think so. Could we break our way by force? And all at our heels, all hell should rise with blackest insurrection to confound heaven's purest light? Yet our great enemy, all uncorrupted, would on his throne sit unpolluted. And the ethereal mold incapable of stain would soon expel her mischief and purge off the baser fire victorious. You can't defeat God. What were you thinking? Thus repulsed, our final hope is flat despair. And he goes on to say, the only thing God can do is annihilate us completely. And he says, who wants to lose this intellectual being? These thoughts that wander through the universe. Listen, I'd rather sit down here with my mind still intact than be totally and completely obliterated, never to exist again. Well, you know, if we hang around long enough, we will adapt to the environment and we'll get used to it. And the flames won't seem as hot. And maybe eventually what seems like torture now won't in the future. Well, Belial, we're told at 226, with words clothed in reason's garb, counseled ignoble ease and peaceful sloth. And then Mammon comes along. Now, Mammon is the entrepreneur. This place isn't so bad. Look around here. Minerals, gems. Look, get out there and dig a bit. We can dig up all kinds of useful energy sources. There are building materials here. We can create a pretty nice city out of this place. There's nothing here now, but, you know, this area has a lot of promise. Besides, guess what? Nobody's ever going to try to take it from us. And Belial says, you know, face it. What if God should relent? God should say, oh, all right. Looking down at us. Come on back. Are you sorry for what you did? Come on back. I forgive you. And Belial says, you want to sit around singing hymns all day? Oh, that's so, Quaker meeting, Puritan church, Oh, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I couldn't stand it. I've got a taste of freedom now. No, we've got to go on our own. And so he scarce had finished 285, when such murmur filled the assembly as when hollow rocks retain the sound of blustering winds, just the way I feel about almost every committee meeting I've ever been in. And there is applause, and his sentence pleased, advising peace for such another field of battle they dreaded worse than hell. And so, now Beelzebub gets up. Now, you have to figure out that this entire debate hasn't been a debate at all. What Satan has done is withheld a key piece of information from all the millions around him. And he and Beelzebub have been, you might say, manipulating the crowd here. They've exhausted themselves. They can't think of any other ways to proceed. And then Beelzebub says, by the way, I've heard that God has created this new world. really? Haven't heard about that one. Oh, yes. And Satan, why don't you tell us about your plans for this new world? So, next time you call a committee meeting, keep the punchline to yourself. Keep that little bit of information concealed until everybody else has blown himself out, and then you bring it up. Oh, by the way, we just received a grant for $500,000, and you know the rest. Well, let's look over now. You remember there's a moment when Comus is entranced by the lady. And we can see that there's an element of lust, of course, in Comus's attempt to get her to yield to nature and pleasure. But of course, nature is fallen nature in the Christian world. It is nature that has suffered some harm, and nature has to be redeemed. So Comus's argument then for nature is to yield to fallen nature. And this is not terribly different from what Satan is working on. There is a great speech of Satan's in book 4. Beginning at line 31. This is a soliloquy worthy of Shakespeare, and it is here, I think, that Milton really does rise to Shakespearean heights. This is more subtle even than Iago. Satan looks at the sun, which apparently he hasn't seen for a while, or ever, come to think of it, because this is the new world that God has created after the fall of the rebelling angels, that is. O thou that with surpassing glory crowned looked'st from thy sole dominion like the God of this new world. Now again, Satan is speaking in terms of pagan solar deities, is he not? He's admiring the reign of the sun over this new world, at whose sight all the stars hide their diminished heads. He's admiring. It's a beautiful line, really. All the stars hide their diminished heads. It's an excellent example of the kind of poetry that is in considerable evidence throughout Comus, as a matter of fact. To thee I call, but with no friendly voice, and add thy name, O sun. And surely there's a pun here, though he doesn't know it yet, to tell thee how I hate thy beams that bring to my remembrance from what state I fell, how glorious once above thy sphere, till pride and worse ambition threw me down, warring in heaven against heaven's matchless king. Wherefore? Now, this is the first indication we've had in Satan of self-doubt. He actually asked himself, not at this point, why did I do it? Up until now, we've had a Satan who was angry, self-assured, on the right side, injured wrongfully, and so on. He deserved no such return from me, whom he created what I was, in thy bright eminence, and with his good unbraided none. Nor was his service hard. What could be less than to afford him praise, the easiest recompense, and pay him thanks? How do you? This is Satan. And we have to stop for a minute and say, oh, he knows, doesn't he? He really does know. Yet all is good proved ill in me. Dad, I just don't know why I stole the car and went out and got drunk and wrecked it and got arrested. And can you get me out of jail? I know I did something really bad, but can you come get me? And yet, he says, wrought but malice. So Satan is a very rational being, really, when you get right down to it. But he turns reason to a different purpose. So he knows that he's done wrong, and he knows that even when he has nothing to complain about, he manages to twist these things into something else. Nor was his service hard, he says. What could be less than to afford him praise? The easiest recompense. So, he says, lifted up so high, I disdained subjection and thought one step higher would set me highest, and a moment quit, that is, get rid of, the debt immense of endless gratitude, so burdensome, still paying, still to owe. Now, this speech consists of a series of excuses, call them reasons from Satan's point of view, for his revolt. And the first one is, how would you like to be in debt all your existence, never capable of getting out of debt? You always owe something to the man. So forgetful, but look, now he jumps back to the other side. Forgetful, what from him I still received. I forgot that even as I had this burdensome debt towards him, I was still enjoying what he gave me, and understood not that a grateful mind, by owing, owes not, but still pays at once indebted and discharged. What burden then? So even Satan knows that that excuse won't wash. It's very clear to him. So he takes a different tack. Oh, had his powerful destiny ordained me some inferior angel, I had stood then happy. Why did he make me so great? See, if I hadn't been such a great angel, then I wouldn't have been tempted this way. If I'd been one of those lesser angels, I'd never said, hey, I'm going to be equal to God. And thought would never have entered my mind. It's his fault for making me so wonderful. It's all God's fault. I had stood then happy. No unbounded hope had raised ambition. Yet why not? Oh, wait a minute. Some other power as great might have aspired, and me, though mean, mediocre, drawn to his part. And notice here that the rhythm, we started out, Satan says, and he says, but I could have, and he says, but I know that, but you notice that the alternations between what I know is right and what I did get shorter and shorter here. The rhythm changes in this speech. But other powers as great fell not, but stand unshaken from within or from without to all temptations armed. Oh, wait a minute, you know. Not everybody fell. There were some angels who were as wonderful as I, and they didn't fall. And there were some not so wonderful as I, and who also didn't fall. Hadst thou the same free will and power to stand? Thou hadst. And this is terribly important because it's at the center of the whole poem, as it is at the center of Christian doctrine. And by the way, it's not a particularly Calvinistic position. And that is because I think Milton was not really he wasn't an extreme Calvinist, let's put it that way. What he did believe, however, was that Satan had free will and no need of grace. Thou hadst the same free will and power to stand. Whom hast thou then, or what to accuse, but heaven's free love dealt equally to all? And this is where his argument reaches its ultimate perversity. Who is to blame? What is to blame? God's love, dealt equally to all. In other words, it's too much of a democracy of love for the likes of me. Be then his love accursed, since love or hate to me alike it deals eternal woe. Who gives a, literally, damn whether God loves me or not? The effect is the same. Nay, he says, nay, cursed be thou. Me. I take full responsibility, since against his, thy will chose freely what it now so justly rues. Me, miserable. An interesting construction. No verb, but it sums everything up. It doesn't matter how many arguments you give me, doesn't matter how logical they are, doesn't matter how right they are, doesn't matter how generous they are, the result for me is the same. Me, miserable. Curse me, curse myself. Which way shall I fly? Infinite wrath and infinite despair. Which way I fly is hell. Myself am hell. And in the lowest deep, a lower deep, still threatening to devour me, opens wide, to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven. Oh, then at last relent. Is there no place left for repentance? None for pardon left? None left but by submission. And that word disdain forbids me in my dread of shame among the spirits beneath, whom I seduced with other promises and other vaunts, than to submit, boasting I could subdue the omnipotent. And then he goes on to say something extraordinary, because here what Satan has done is to enter into the cast of mind of the pagan epic hero. Honor forbids him to admit that he was wrong. Honor among thieves, if you will. Look, they look at me, they have no idea how I suffer. All they see is this great, magnificent being. They little know how dearly I abide that boast so vain, while they adore me on the throne of hell. So this is a fascinating portrait of a twisted mind. Well ahead of its time, I would say. But there are clearly people who think exactly like that. They're so overwhelmed by their own situation and so incapable of getting out of the bind of their own self-esteem. I can't tell everybody I was wrong. What will they think? Then they'll accuse me of misleading them. I will be responsible for all of them. I've got to keep up the appearance of my greatness. I can't yield to God. This is all terribly, terribly familiar. It's a Milton who was blind, who was out of not only power and service, but was terribly alone. All he could do was write poetry. And Satan, who says, no matter how far I fall, another chasm opens up below. We can see that Satan suffers from eternal acrophobia. He is always fearful of falling. No matter how far he falls, he still knows that he can fall further and probably will. Well, all right, now let's see what happens in the world of marriage. Because I think we, you know, of course, that Milton had three wives. The first one, he married young, and she ran away from home after a week. So he went out and met with her parents, and they persuaded her to come back, and she came back eventually and died in childbirth. He had a second wife who also died in childbirth, and then a third wife who was apparently, we gather, a bit of a shrew. And it was probably the second wife. He wrote a famous poem, Methought I Saw My Late Espoused Saint, a sonnet. We're not sure whether that was the first wife or the second wife. We think it's probably the second wife that he's referring to, who appears to him in a dream and then fades away. It's based, of course, on the scene when Patroclus meets, or Achilles sees a vision of Patroclus in the Aeneid. Well, Milton, I think, understood women, and he takes this interesting opportunity to write a poem in which the woman seems to be the villain, or at least the weak person, but according to the theology of the poem, it is actually Eve who is responsible for mankind's rising to a higher place. And it's interesting, if you look at Adam and Eve carefully, you will see that Milton seems to be saying something about the way we behave. That is, Adam is the man who plays it safe. He plays by the rules. He does what he's told. Eve has imagination, and she's a bit adventurous. She's willing to try new things. Now, she's a little gullible, understatement. On the other hand, what would you do if a snake came up and started talking to you? I think I would go immediately to my doctor, but she didn't have one. Right, so let's take a look now at Adam and Eve. And how much time do we have? Just enough. Make a point or two. So Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden, and they are happy, and they are innocent, and they are enjoying a paradisal environment. And they go to work, but it's not really work. And they stay together all day, and they don't get tired of one another. And they speak to one another in the most amazingly formal language. Now, listen. There, among the upper class, it was not unusual for a husband and wife to address one another in formal language. In French, for example, it was not unusual for a woman to vouvoyer, use the formal second person, in speaking with her husband in the upper classes. This is because, of course, not all marriages were marriages of passion and love. In fact, a lot of them among our aristocracy were not. But Adam and Eve are, you might say, natural aristocrats here. And they speak in elevated language. So look at book 5. Eve has had a bad dream. And at line 28, Adam says, Eve says to Adam, "O soul, S-O-L-E, in whom my thoughts find all repose, my glory, my perfection, glad I see thy face and morn return. For I this night, such night till this I never passed, have dreamed, if dreamed, not as I often wont, of thee, works of day past or morrow's next design, but of offense and trouble, which my mind knew never till this irksome night." And then she goes on to describe this vision she has when Satan comes, the serpent comes along, or somebody comes along. She doesn't say a serpent quite yet. She's rather vague about this. And he walks up to the forbidden tree. And he praises the fruit. And he goes on and on. And notice that Eve says, "I am so glad it was just a dream." Now, I don't know, those of you who are married, have you ever had a circumstance occur? I can remember a few. Somebody waking up saying, "Oh, thank God it was a dream." But listen to Adam consoling, "Best image of myself." It's an interesting way to begin, because he's saying, look, it could happen to anybody. Of course, anybody means me, because there isn't anybody else. "And dearer half, the trouble of thy thoughts this night in sleep affects me equally." He says, "I fear that it has sprung from evil, yet evil wins." Wait a minute. There isn't any evil in us. What is evil? Why do we even know what evil is? How does Adam know that there's evil? Does he know it in an Augustinian sense? It's a privation of good. Imagine what it'd be like if we didn't have everything the way we have it. It would be evil. We're not quite clear how Eve knows that something's wrong, but of course we know that an external force has been operative here. But how does Adam know? Well, Adam is an amateur psychologist in good 17th century fashion, and he says, well, look, there's this thing called fancy. And, when you're asleep and you're not in control, fancy gets in there and does all sorts of strange things. Dr. Freud, help us here. "Yet, be not sad, evil into the mind of God or man may come and go so unapproved and leave no spot or blame behind." So here is consoling Adam, very calm, very rational. And throughout, you notice that they go out to work. Why did they go to work? They don't have to go to work. Well, what else is there to do? You play around. You say, well, let's go do some gardening. Let's go clean up this mess. But already there is implied a command of man over the natural world. Already there is implied something not quite perfect about Eden. If you have to go around and pull vines away because they're going in the wrong direction, and so on. And so it seems that Adam's and Eve's wills cannot be free unless they can already imagine an alternative to what there is, unless they can imagine a nature that's just a little bit better than the nature that they live with, and unless they can imagine a privation that's a lot worse than where they are. How can they have a choice if they can imagine it? So here, fancy, the ability to see something that is not present, that is not real for you right now. This is essential in the whole concept of free will. And this is Milton's whole point. And in fact, to prove conclusively that you're free, it may well be that you'll have to test your freedom. And this is, of course, exactly what happens. Now, what I love in Paradise Lost is book 9. Especially around the temptation scene. And the serpent leads her to the forbidden tree in 6:47. And you notice already Eve has become something of a wit. "Serpent," she says, "we might have spared our coming hither." I can just hear her saying this. "Oh, serpent, we might have spared our coming hither. You're wasting my time. Fruitless to me, though fruit be here to excess." A little pun. "The credit of whose virtue rest with thee, wondrous indeed, it causes such effects. But of this tree we may not taste nor touch. God so commanded, and left that command sole daughter of his voice." And so the tempter, of course, works on her. Really? How can you be lords of all in heaven and earth if you can't do what you want with this tree? Answer me that. And Eve says, well, she just repeats what she had already said. We can have everything else, we can do anything we want with it, but this one we can't. God says, don't touch it or you will die. Of course, she doesn't know what that means. You realize? She doesn't know what death means. For her, death would have to be the opposite of existence, so total and complete non-existence. And, of course, the serpent then... Now, you know what's happened here. Why did Adam and Eve separate? They had this wonderful little, almost marital tiff. Eve says, we're not getting anywhere. Have you noticed? You know what happens? We get to work on the garden, and we kind of kiss and hug and play around. And, you know, pretty soon it's time to go back home, and we haven't done much at all. All these plants, they grow so fast. They grow faster than we can manage because we get distracted by one another. I think we should separate, and then we will become more efficient. So Eve has already figured out something that was many, many years, well, centuries, well, millennia in the coming, and that is the notion of the separation of labor and specialization. So she's already seen the way that you can get things done. Let's get everybody to an assigned task, and then we'll get it all done. And Adam says, we don't have to get it all done. And Eve, you know, she doesn't like that. And then Adam says, in effect, look, honey, you know, I just don't think this is a good idea. Oh, you don't trust me, do you? Well, of course I trust you. But you see, what do you think will happen if we separate? Well, I'm afraid that something bad might happen to you. Such as? He says, well, I don't know. You remember God said we had this enemy that we had to watch out for. Oh, so you think that you can confront the enemy, but poor weak little me, I can't. I'm just a woman. I'm not strong enough without my man to encounter the enemy. Adam says, no, that's not what I mean at all. Well, prove it then. Let's try it once. Yes. Now, one of the things that commentators have noted about Adam and Eve is that, well, they say that Adam's sin is uxoriousness, bending too readily to the will of one's wife, from a sin which I suffer from all the time. I'm altogether ready to do whatever my spouse wants, except there are certain fruits I don't eat. I don't know if they're the same that were prohibited in the Garden of Eden, but anyway, the tree of knowledge. Okay, so you're afraid that I'll know more than you. That's why you don't want me to go back to school. No, yeah, so what? Well, Adam is stuck. You know, there is no good answer here, is there? There just isn't a good answer. Adam is really stuck. So away Eve goes, and Satan sees his chance, and she commits all the seven deadly sins at once. She gorges greedily on the apple. She disobeys. She gets drunk. That is, heightened as with wine, jocund and boon. And then she starts praising the tree. And then she says, I'm going to plan to have more of this. In other words, she's getting addicted to the tree of forbidden fruit. And then she says, but here's the problem. 8:16. But to Adam, in what sort shall I appear? It's the first time she's been concerned with how she's going to approach her husband and what she's going to say. And this is the real turning point, I think. So what am I going to say? Shall I to him make known as yet my change and give him to partake full happiness with me? Or rather not. But keep the odds of knowledge in my power without co-partner. Now Eve's saying, this is my chance to rule the roost. I just won't tell him. So as to add what is lacking in female sex, the more to draw his love and render me more equal, and perhaps a thing not undesirable, sometime superior, for inferior who is free. That's exactly Satan's reason, right? Inferior who is free. You're always obliged to the other person. You can never pay back what you owe. So poor Eve. She says, but wait a minute. And now there enters into the picture, for the first time, ladies and gentlemen, in history, the other woman. What? You didn't know there was another woman in paradise? Not yet, but Eve has fancy. She can now imagine another woman. What if God have seen and death ensue? Then I shall be no more an Adam wedded to another Eve. Shall live with her enjoying, I extinct. A death to think. Oh no, he's not going to get away with that. Confirm then I resolve, Adam shall share with me in bliss or woe. So dear I love him, that with him all deaths I could endure, without him live no life. Now, this last sentence is a peculiar one, in a way, because in the end, Eve is saying, I'm doing what I do out of love. But is it love for Adam, or is it self-love? It's not clear. I think Eve thinks it's love for Adam, but I think we see that she doesn't want him to have another Eve. Well, then she finds Adam. And I'd like to imagine here that Eve comes up looking a little bit intoxicating and saying, hast thou not wondered, Adam, at my stay? At light 8:56. thee I have missed, and thought it long deprived thy presence, agony of love till now, not felt, nor shall be twice. For nevermore mean I to try what rash untried I sought, the pain of absence from thy sight. And does she do all the things she said she might do? No, she doesn't. She tells him right away, look, you remember that tree? Boy, that is some tree, she says. It has opened my eyes, growing up to grow to Godhead. And so she says, you have to try this. When you're planning on a wedding, you know, you have to go around to all kinds of vendors, including the people who are trying to sell you cakes. And I have heard that line, you've got to try this, so many times in the last week that I tell you I'm going to have to go on a purge binge to get back to my normal weight. Anyhow, Eve, with countenance blithe, her story told, but in her cheek distemper flushing glowed. Now, what happens subsequently is that Adam, of course, immediately, and this is interesting, Adam immediately says, I cannot imagine life without you. And so Adam does what he does out of love for Eve. Scholars like to point out that this is uxoriousness, but I'd like to point out that there's something noble about it. But it's kind of the last noble thing that Adam does, if you want to know the truth, because when God comes down, God says, you usually run to greet me. Why are you hiding? And they creep out guiltily. And Adam, in a long and somewhat tangled speech, says, well, it was this, and we were, you know, busy. And then finally he says, and then God says, ask him, what have you done? And he says, well, listen, you remember that that creature you gave me as a helpmate to make things better for me? Well, she gave me this fruit. She's the one who's responsible. And then God turns to Eve. Now, Adam's speech is a good 50-something lines. He really beats around the bush. God turns to Eve and says, what do you have to say? And she says, one line. The serpent me beguiled, and I did eat. And this is, in my mind, Eve's redemption. She takes it square on the chin, you might say. She admits what she did in one simple, direct line. She doesn't beat around the bush. And I think we see, then, in all of this, of course, there's nothing new in the Christian notion that Eve will be compensated for by another woman. But here the whole notion is that Adam and Eve now do have a certain integrity, even after the fall, even after they have tasted sin, even after they've seen the alternative lifestyle for a bit and alternative feelings. Nevertheless, they are still a couple, and they are still a couple who care about one another. And so this, I think, ultimately has something to do with the chastity that Milton's talking about in Comus, as a matter of fact. There is a kind of moral excellence, clouded over though it is, in Adam and Eve after the fall. And in the rest of Paradise Lost, then Milton makes the point that he makes in that last song in Comus, that if Adam and Eve are no longer capable of rising out of the condition in which they find themselves, and notice they go into the future at the end of the poem with steps that are slow, and they go on their way out of paradise. But at the same time, there's this notion that heaven ultimately will stoop to bring them back up. So anyway, it's been fun, and I'll look forward to talking with you about opera. And not just opera, but what happens to the human voice in the course of the 17th century. Did you know something happened to it? Oh, yes. Tune in about a month or so.